From the KGOU studios, I'm Rebecca Cruz, filling in while Suzette Gerlot is off this week, and welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis joins me to discuss this week's airstrikes in Syria, as well as the decision by the Obama administration to send more troops to the region.
If you've got intelligence on the ground watching when people leave or go out of what we suspect is their office, you can have much more intelligence. And that means you can kill the leadership with greater accuracy and more frequently.
Then I'll talk with activist Selma Haji Halilovic. She was just 16 when war broke out in Bosnia in the 1990s, and she started working for a shelter for women who were raped by soldiers as a psychological warfare tactic.
When you live in a war, you don't know will you wake up tomorrow. You can't say, okay, today I'm living in a war, tomorrow I'll go to a beach. It's not possible.
But first, the news. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz. Joshua Landis, thank you for joining me today.
Always a pleasure.
Well, we have a ceasefire that you're aware of from February in dealing with Syria, and we have the two kind of outside forces or countries in that, the United States and Russia, and both seem to have made some moves this week. So I wanted to talk about both of those moves, starting first with Russia and working apparently with the government in Syria to engage in a number of airstrikes, particularly around Aleppo. Some of these strikes seem to have gotten at civilian populations. A hospital seems to have been hit, Doctors Without Borders. They had casualties last year in a similar airstrike, and now they're having to face casualties again. So what's going on here? What is the government's role in this? What is Russia's role in this?
Well, the ceasefire seems to be breaking down. The UN special envoy, who's been leading peace talks in Geneva, is beseeching both Russia and the United States to do whatever it takes to keep the ceasefire going, keep the talks going, because he sees them and all of his efforts coming to naught. And then we're just back to the beginning again with both sides pounding each other. And the trouble is that the ceasefire, which has lasted much longer than anybody thought it would, was brought about really because of Russian and U.S. pressure on their sides. And both of them gave blandishments saying, if you come to the table, we will support you with more weapons and so forth if the other side doesn't do anything. Plus, if you don't come to the table, we're not going to support you. So both sides came under severe pressure. They didn't come really to strike a deal. And I think both sides thought they were not going to get any kind of a deal at Geneva. They were going in order to get more arms, and they have. And just the other day, James Clapper, the head of national intelligence, said that Syria's awash in man pads. These man-carried ground-to-air missile to shoot down Russian planes, that's new. And Russia has been supporting Syria. So both sides are gearing up to go back to war. And that's the real problem. How do you stop this? The ceasefire left raggedy partition lines. All sides are arming their people. It's very difficult to see how we're going to get from here to a real ceasefire. And, you know, at the heart of this is that the United States doesn't want a partition of Syria.
Right, because this is, as you say, is a return to conflicts or a return to the civil war that we've been experiencing they've been experiencing since 2011. The other side of that is our concern and the U.S. concern about ISIS. And so the Obama administration this week said we're going to send 250 special ops, making it still, I think, around 300 that are going to be there. But that's a completely different conflict that seems to be waging at the same time.
It is a different conflict because that is about ISIS, which is in eastern Syria, and it's America's war in a sense. There's a coalition, but it's really America's war. And President Obama has tried to draw a sharp line between the Syrian civil war, which is 1,000-plus rebel groups versus the Assad government that's taking place largely on the western part of Syria, and the eastern part of Syria, where ISIS dominates. And the United States has been fighting alongside Kurds, and it's this little army that they're trying to build up in order to destroy ISIS. So those are two different things. And of course, the center of the news story was Obama had been telling us for years, no boots on the ground, no boots on the ground in Syria. And all of a sudden, you know, his spokesperson for the State Department is trying to explain how 300 and some odd you know, special forces are not boots on the ground.
And boots on the ground, but
the
what are 300 people?
Cartoonists are doing things with them wearing sneakers and stuff like that.
Of course. but what are they hoping to gain? 300, 250 additional?
Well, I think they want to hurt ISIS more. And that what they need to do is have special operations people who can go in after an airstrike and take out leadership. Kidnap them. They've done this before. They've carried out important computers, which opened up the door for tons more intelligence. So if you've got spotters on the ground, if you've got intelligence on the ground watching when people leave or go out of what we suspect is their office, you can have much more intelligence. And that means you can kill the leadership with greater accuracy and more frequently.
So it looks like the ceasefire is all but over. And we also have this situation with the U.S. getting more involved in trying to deal with ISIS. And we'll continue to watch these two stories happening in Syria. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have any questions or comments about this conversation, let us know online at kgou.org. You can also find us at KGOU's Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. Joshua tweets articles and photos from his widely read blog, Syria Comment, at Joshua_Landis. While you're on our website, you can subscribe to our podcast and find years worth of past episodes. Next, I'll talk with Selma Haji Halilovic. She's a Bosnian human rights activist who won the University of Oklahoma's 2016 Clyde Snow Social Justice Award. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz. When my guest was just a teenager, war broke out in her native Bosnia-Herzegovina. The vacuum left by the breakup of Yugoslavia led to conflicts throughout the 1990s that culminated with countless war crimes and thousands of dead and displaced in the Balkans. The wars deeply affected Selma Haji Halilovic, and she spent her career helping vulnerable populations affected by those and other conflicts. The University of Oklahoma honored her work with the 2016 Clyde Snow Social Justice Award. Selma Haji Halilovic, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you for having me here.
Tell us a little bit about how you came to activism and what your role was and maybe how that has inspired you through these last 20 years.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why I became an activist. There is no explanation that I could say I read this book or then I found this definition interesting and I decided to join. I would say it was rather a necessity, a desire of a young person to fill out her time and to leave the house in a times of great desperation. That was at that time in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Basically, I was in high school when the war started. I was in a medical high school, so to say, training to become a nurse. I had a great aspirations to become a surgeon one day, but then the war started and it turned my life ups and down. So many of you probably learned about war from books, from movies, and some of you have family members involved in war in various ways. But to live in a war, that's a very specific, I can't call it lifestyle, I can't call it stage of life, but it's something very, very specific. When you live in a war, you don't know will you wake up tomorrow. You can't say, okay, today I'm living in a war, tomorrow I'll go to a beach. It's not possible because roads are closed. You don't have electricity. I was one of the happiest moments of my life was actually when we got electricity and water at the same time. And I was watching the washing machine doing its circle. I grew up in Africa. I was traveling a lot before the war. So I didn't really know how to wash clothes on my hands. But it's something that you have to learn if you want to survive, if you want to help your family survive. I had no idea what cooking was about, you know, how to make a bread. I mean, like, of course, you go to a shop and you buy bread. That's how you make bread. And then suddenly you find yourself that there are no shops, there is no bread in the shops, and there is no money that to buy that bread that doesn't even exist in the shops. So you don't have electricity, you don't have water, the roads are closed. Not having electricity means, like, you know, you can't watch movies, like, you know, there is no TV. At that time, there was no internet. There was something else was later developed. Your friends are going and you don't know, will you ever see them again? You have people coming to your hometown with terrible, terrible stories that you just can't, you know, it's not possible. Like, who are those people, what they are talking about? And then you experience the first shelling or the first avio bombing. That was one of my first experiences when airplanes from our former joint state Yugoslavia, the GNA airplanes, bombed my hometown of Zenica. So you don't know what's going on. You just know that somebody wants to kill you for a reason that you don't really understand. And I still, 20-something years later, I still don't understand. So that's something that is very important for us back there in the Balkans, is that we don't understand why this has happened to us. Those terrible war atrocities, those terrible crimes against humanity, those terrible killings. Why? It's a still a big question. So you become, as a young person, you become depressed. You don't really know what to do with yourself, with your life. I have to say, I'm coming from a family that has a very strong feminist activist history. My grandmother used to provide literacy classes for women during the Second World War. My mom is a pediatrician who was very much involved in providing support to kids and to their mothers. And she obviously decided that her daughter will probably go insane if she stays at home. So she took me to visit something that just started being built. It was a center for women victims of war rape. I think at that time, I had no idea what war rape was about. I just knew that it was a center for women who were coming as refugees and their kids. There were some German women around. There were some Bosnian and Herzegovinian women around. Women of different nationalities, of social backgrounds. They were all trying to do something. I was 17 at that time. And that's where I grew up, if I could say so. That's a place where I become a woman. That's a place where I learned what life is about. That's a place where I learned what war is about. That's a place where I learned what violence against women during wartime means. I don't know, can you imagine, you know, you are still young, you are sitting, you are trying to have a coffee with girls that are about your age, and then suddenly something happens and they start crying or screaming and going again through what happened to them in either raping camps or elsewhere where they were raped either by one individual or by groups of individuals. And you just ask yourself, why would anybody do something like that? I got the chance to grow up. Instead of like having fun with other kids from school or from all of my age, I really had to, but it was my choice. You know, the important thing is I choose that because I felt that I have to do something. And I wish that there were more of us who have chosen maybe not to be part of like the world where I decided I want to be part and do something. There were other things that we could have done, maybe. But it's a question of my own choice. I choose to be involved in something that later on has simply shaped my life.
That's Selma Hadzi-Halilovic describing her experiences in the Balkan Wars during the 1990s. We'll hear her thoughts about the 1995 Dayton Peace Accords that brought an end to the 3.5-year war in her native Bosnia right after this short break. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm filling in this week for our regular host, Suzette Gerlot. Let's get back to my conversation with Selma Haji Halilovic. She's been telling me about her experience growing up in Bosnia during the country's war in the 1990s and how it inspired her to become an activist. She recently won the University of Oklahoma's 2016 Clyde Snow Social Justice Award. We have just this last year marked 20 years since the Dayton Peace Accords that brought an end to the violence, though perhaps not the tensions. But there were not a lot of women involved, even though they were such an important aspect of the conflict. Why weren't more women involved, and what could they have brought to the table? Why is it so important to have women in these post-conflict discussions?
Well, I would leave kind of scientific answer to those scholars who are trying to make a research on the participation and role of women, especially in politics during war context. But from somebody who's been there 20 years ago, we knew very little about Dayton, so we were not informed at all. We were already actively participating in kind of social politics. We were taking care of women survivors of war violence. We were taking care of refugees. Women were making sure that that certain aspects of the society still exist. But believe me, we were not informed about the Dayton Peace Agreement. It was only later that when peace finally came, we had a chance to speak with some of the women who were in a certain way directly involved, such as Ambassador Swanee Hahn, the former U.S. ambassador to Vienna, who hosted, pre-negotiations of the Washington Peace Agreement. And when she spoke from her perspective, how it was to host peace negotiations and how she felt when she didn't saw that none of the sides from our war brought women to negotiation tables. So none of them thought that, women had something to say, which unfortunately was a very bad judgment. And we are still bearing the consequences of that very, very bad judgment. Because the great international forces invited only male representatives to Dayton to basically negotiate the peace agreement. And men at that time, and even today, unfortunately, let's say that they were not so much interested in social aspects of peace negotiations. So they did agree on the sort of division of Bosnia and Herzegovina. As you know, we have a very complicated constitutional system and different jurisdictions and so on. But they never reflected on how this very complicated division of Bosnia and Herzegovina will affect the life of daily citizens. Issues such as health were not on their agenda. Issues such as education were not on their agenda. Transportation, why should they worry about the transportation when they have, all those expensive special cars that are escorted by police or military or helicopters and so on and so on. Ordinary citizens do not have all those luxuries, so to say. And 20 years after the war, we are talking about segregated education. We are talking about two schools under one roof. We are talking about the fact that we cannot get health protection in every city of Bosnia and Herzegovina. There is an extraordinary discrimination and so many administrative problems. Education, I think that we have 14 laws on education, and we are a country of less than 3.5 million of people. So potable water, just name it, environment. I think that if women were engaged, if they were asked about priorities, if they were invited at the negotiation table, the Dayton peace agreement would actually bring more than just stopping the immediate shooting. It will bring a certain sense of prosperity for the future. 21 years after the Dayton peace agreement, we are really struggling to build our lives. So there is no war anymore, so there is no immediate shooting, but the tensions are still very high.
The ethnic groups, as you said, segregated education, segregated in geography in many ways.
Exactly. And I have to say that the international community is not helping. In a certain way, there are new conflicts around the world, and Bosnia and Herzegovina is not the priority of the agenda. And I won't be saying that it is still the responsibility of the international community to watch over Bosnia and Herzegovina fully. But I think that the international peace efforts, when it comes to Bosnia and Herzegovina, have failed on so many different tracks. That, yes, in a certain way, it is still the responsibility of all of those involved in the peace negotiation process to make sure that we have new peace negotiations, that we now try to repair and use the lessons learned to make women participate at the peace negotiation table, to think more about the society and problems about everyday citizens, ordinary citizens in their everyday life than about this high politics and really try to I can't say make a fresh start. I mean, we will never have a fresh start. But to make really this little piece of world finally live in peace.
Well, it's an important lesson, of course, that post-conflict is not a set period of time. The violence ends and there's a lot of rebuilding to do, both emotionally, politically, and economically and socially, and that will continue to be a challenge for Bosnia, for the Balkan region, and for the international community. And also, as you said, that there are lessons to be learned here as we look at other conflicts around the world. Well, we could talk on and on about this, just a fascinating topic. And we thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story and your country's story with us.
Thank you for having me here.
You've been listening to my conversation with Selma Hadzihalilović. She's a social justice activist who received the University of Oklahoma's 2016 Clyde Snow Social Justice Award for her work with victims of war rape during the Bosnian War in the 1990s. There's more information online at kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Our researcher is Miranda Wilson, and this show was produced by Brian Hardzinski. For Joshua Landis, I'm Rebecca Cruz.